Then Jesus withdraws with the disciples and he starts telling them what's going to happen. He's going to be executed by these leaders, but in doing so, they're going to create their own demise, because instead of accepting Jesus's way of the peaceful kingdom, they're going to take the road of revolt against Rome, and so Jerusalem and its temple are going to be destroyed. But, Jesus says, that is not the end of the story. He's going to be vindicated after his death by his resurrection, and one day he'll return and set up his kingdom over all nations. And so in the meanwhile, the disciples need to stay alert and stay committed to just announcing Jesus and his kingdom and spreading the good news. And so with all of that ringing in the disciples' ears, the story comes to its climax. That night, Jesus takes the disciples aside and he celebrates a Passover meal with them. The Passover retells the story of Israel's rescue from slavery through the death of the Passover lamb. And then Jesus takes the bread and the wine from this meal as new symbols, showing that his coming death would be a sacrifice that would redeem his people from slavery to sin and evil.
Okay. This morning we're reading out of my green St. Patrick's Day Bible. Out of Matthew 26. Starting in verse 36. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So you could not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. And then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. My betrayer is at hand." My friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Having faith in Jesus is really easy when life is good, right? When God doesn't ask you to do anything hard, we don't really have any problem following him. But humans are, as a rule, averse to hardship. Now, people in some places live their whole lives in hardship, and so they don't shrink from it, and they understand the basic rule of life, which is that nothing that is worth having comes easy, and nothing that is worth doing is easy. But those of us who live fairly comfortable lives, which includes pretty much all of us in this room, we don't buy it. I mean, we might say we do. We might understand intellectually that hard work leads to things that are worth having, but we don't really buy it deep down. We aren't willing to do hard things. We aren't willing to endure some measure of difficulty even now if it means a much better life down the road, which is why every politician promises you quick fixes, right? Right? It's why they always promise to lower taxes without explaining how they're going to replace the revenue. Right? If a politician in an election year tells us there are no quick fixes, solving this country's problems will be hard, it will take time and sacrifice, none of you are voting for them, right? No one wants to vote for that guy, which is why none of them say it. This mindset, it infiltrates our faith. It's not actually unique to us. It's a universal human condition that we will follow whichever God promises us the easiest path to salvation. If that's Jesus, great. But the moment that money, sex, power, or greed offers us an easier way, promises an easier path, we'll abandon Jesus in a heartbeat for the easy gods. None of us wants to bear the weight of the cross. Can you put the first picture up, Bobby? I don't know how you can see it. This is the Garden of Gethsemane. Those are the olive trees. You got little paths in between it. Or at least this is what's left of the original olive grove. The name Gethsemane means oil press, and so there would have been olive trees and oil production happening here. These trees have been preserved. It's not actually a very big area right now, so the original grove would have been a lot bigger. There we go. Now you can see it really well. Thank you. And when you're in there, by the way, you can look across the valley and see Jerusalem. You can see the Dome of the Rock where the temple was from the garden. And when you go across the valley and you're in the high priest's palace where Jesus was put on trial and beaten and held in a cell, you can look out from the doorway of that palace and you can see across the valley the Garden of Gethsemane. These places are all very close. You can actually still today walk the path that Jesus would have been dragged on by the guards who captured him as they took him down one side of the valley and up the other. So these are the trees. You want to go to the next one? This is the oldest tree in the garden. This tree is over 2,000 years old. That means this tree was there on the night when Jesus was arrested. The disciples might well have fallen asleep under this tree. Jesus might have prayed under this tree. And now we take selfies with it. In that church next door, do we have the third picture? So this rock is in the church next door, and tradition holds that this rock is the place where Jesus was standing when he began to sweat drops of blood. It's probably about 70 feet or so from that tree you just saw. And, you know, we hear these things and we think, well, okay, but how do they really know that's the spot? And the answer is, do you really think that the disciples forgot the spot where Jesus prayed drops of blood? And do you really think they didn't go and tell people later on and bring them to the garden and say, look, right here is where he was praying? Now, they may have been a little off, but if it's not there, it's close by. And I show you all these because I find it helpful to remind ourselves from time to time that these are real places and real people. And even though you can't travel there right this second, you can, in general, still go and visit the actual places where these stories happened, where there are people who have been living there and their families have been living there since biblical times. Those trees were there the night Jesus was there. You can go and you can stand under them in the same places where Jesus was. And so Jesus takes the disciples to Gethsemane, but this is not their first night there. They've been camping out in this olive grove for several nights because this is where they've been staying while they celebrate the Passover, which means Judas knows exactly where to find them. Jesus could have relocated. He could have moved their camp somewhere else to avoid being arrested that night if he really wanted to. But he didn't. And he knows exactly what's coming. He knows exactly who is going to betray him. And he deliberately sets up his final confrontation with the evil powers of this world. So he grabs Peter and James and John, the inner circle, right? The ones who saw him transfigured on the mountain. This is a big deal. Every other time that Jesus goes off to pray away from the group, he goes alone. He prays in solitude. This is the only time he has asked for company to come with him while he goes off and prays. He wants his friends with him because he's sorrowful and troubled. Other translations actually say deeply grieved and distressed, which I think maybe captures his emotions in the moment a little better. And he asks his friends to keep watch with him, which means, in other words, right, stay awake with me. I'm too freaked out to sleep. I'm not going to find any rest. I need you to sit with me this night. I need your support. I need your presence with me. I need you to come and pray with me. He has never asked his disciples to do this before. This is something completely new. It's unprecedented. And you'd think they'd be a little keyed into that, right? That maybe they would recognize the gravity of the moment, even if they don't fully understand what's about to happen. This is their beloved teacher, their rabbi, their leader, their friend, the man they've shared their life with for 3 years. And he asks them to stay up with him on the worst night of his life, to keep him company, to lend him the support of their presence in his darkest hour, and they fall asleep. And you saw the ground in that picture. It's not like it's soft grass. It's like gravel and rocks and tree roots. It's not like they were just in a warm, cozy spot. No, they fall asleep. And you can hear how disappointed and hurt Jesus is, right? You couldn't even stay up for 1 hour with me. And then he tells them something. Watch and pray so that you don't fall into temptation. Now, we tend to focus on the second half of what he says there, right? The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Because it sounds nice and philosophical, and it rings true for a lot of us, right? The spirit is willing, and the flesh is weak. Yeah, that makes sense. I understand that. I live that. But actually, the more important part of what he says is the first half. Watch and pray with me so that you don't fall into temptation. Remember that later that very night, Peter is going to deny Jesus 3 times. In fact, every action the disciples take from the moment Jesus is arrested to the moment he is nailed to the cross is wrong. Peter's going to draw his sword and attack the servants. That's wrong. They're all going to flee and scatter, and that's wrong. Not one of them stands by Jesus in his darkest hour. Peter is the one who publicly denies him, but all of them deny him in one way or another because they all run and hide. Peter at least had the courage to show up to the trial. He still denied him, but at least he was there. The rest go and hide. Now, not long before this, he had told them, anyone who wants to follow me has to take up their cross before they can follow me. Well, here was their chance. Here was their chance to take up their cross and follow Jesus, and they abandoned him. When the going got tough, when Jesus shifted from being a public figure protected by popular support to being public enemy number one, even his closest and most devoted followers turned on him. See, we're always looking for the easy way out. For them, the easy way out was, we want a Messiah who's going to raise an army and rebel against the Romans, not one who's going to lay down his life. We want the fastest, most painless way for us to solve a problem. We do this in every aspect of our lives, right? We don't want to be told that the way to improve our physical health is to change our lifestyle, right? To eat more healthy food, less junk food, exercise more, get more sleep, find ways to be more active overall. We want a quick fix. We want a radical diet that'll help us knock off 30 pounds in 30 days. Right? We don't think about the fact that the moment you stop that diet, you gain all the weight back overnight. We don't want to be told that the way to improve our financial situation is to spend less money, cut back our expenses, put more in savings, be more prudent. We want more money and we want it now, so we'll take out a loan or another credit card so we can spend more. Or we'll look for another job that pays more, even if we might be less satisfied there than we are in our current place. We don't want to be told that the way to save our marriage is to spend a lot of time and effort working on it, to improve your communication, learning how you have failed to do your part, because it's easy to blame the other person, or how you can do better, and rebuilding the trust and the intimacy that's been lost, and that this might take months or years. We'd rather divorce and start over with someone new. But if we don't actually change our lifestyle to something healthier, then no diet is going to help, and we'll end up being more unhealthy in the long run, because we'll just give up hope. If we don't cut back our expenses and learn discipline with our money, then getting more money won't help, because you'll just make the problem bigger. You'll get in the exact same mess, but with higher stakes. If we don't learn to work on our marriage and become better husbands and wives, then your second and third and fourth marriages will also fall apart for the same reasons. And we've all seen it happen to people we know, haven't we? The problem with doing things the easy way, or at least the way that seems easy, is that it doesn't usually work out. God could have done things the easy way, which in his case would have been just to wipe us all out and start over with better people, right? And you might recall that he tells Moses in Exodus, he wants to do exactly that. I'm tired of their complaining. I'm going to kill them all and start over. And Moses says, that's not really a good idea. Now, he had a pretty strong self-interest in that, but he didn't, right? Because he'd end up with the same problems in the long run, so God chooses the hard solution. Jesus' prayer in the garden is desperate. It's desperate. He doesn't want to go to the cross. But he always submits that prayer to the will of God. He keeps asking God if there's a plan B, right? An option that doesn't require his death. Father, I'll go through this if it's the only way, but seriously, is there something else we can try first? Right? And the answer was no. There is no plan B. This is how we save the world. Jesus passes the test. His disciples failed. He faces the cross while they run and hide. When he told them to take up their cross if they wanted to follow him, I don't think he was speaking in metaphorical language. I think he was dead serious and quite literal. I think he knew exactly what was going to happen, and he knew that they were going to get the opportunity to take up their cross and follow him, and that they would all miss it. And ironically, one of the criminals who's hung next to him does exactly what Jesus told his disciples to do, doesn't he? He took up his cross, he followed Jesus. Now, we won't ever face that kind of test in our lives. But there were plenty of times during the first several centuries of the church's existence where Christians were asked very literally to take up their cross and follow Jesus, and they did. And there are still places in the world today where people have to put their life on the line if they want to follow Jesus. Places in Africa and India and Southeast Asia and China where Christians really do die because they believe in Jesus. You and I, we might have to sacrifice financial gain. We might have to give up positions of influence. We might have to give up some measure of comfort or worldly pleasure. We might suffer from chronic health problems or the sudden and untimely loss of someone we love. We might lose our jobs. We might lose our homes. Bad things can happen to anyone. Things make it very, very difficult for us, but none of us is going to be nailed to a cross and left to die. And yet plenty of people lose their faith over the things I've just described. Plenty of people won't follow Jesus at all if the path he's leading you down would take you into any of those tests. And the thing is, if everything we say we believe in is true, one day you're going to meet those Christians who were literally crucified for their faith, and millions of others who were killed in equally barbaric and painful ways. Imagine how you'll feel when you explain to them why your faith in Jesus faltered. And you'll have to stand before Jesus and give an account of your life. And what are you going to tell him when he asks you about how you faced difficulty? About the times when you lost your faith in him and followed a different God because they promised a way that was less difficult and less painful. Now, I hope you'll take that seriously, and I hope you'll really ponder it and think about it. But I also want to take us back to the 12 disciples, the ones who abandoned Jesus in his darkest hour because they couldn't bear the weight of the cross. Of those 12, only one is lost forever. Of the other 11, we know that John, at least, was standing at the foot of the cross when Jesus died. And crosses were not tall, and they weren't put up on tops of hills where people couldn't reach them. They were by the roadside, and they were about my height. John could look into Jesus' eyes as he breathed his last breath. He was there at the foot of the cross. He came back, and he witnessed it all. Peter, when Jesus has been raised from the dead, Peter is given the opportunity to proclaim his love for Jesus three times, one for each denial he made. 11 of the 12 will go on to proclaim the resurrection to every corner of the known world. Of those 11, five were crucified. Matthew made it all the way to Ethiopia before he was killed for questioning the morals of the king. But the Ethiopian Orthodox Church still stands today. And it's one of the only countries in Africa where it's been Christian for the majority of its history. Thomas, the one who doubted, the one who needed to stick his hand in the holes in Jesus' side before he would believe, made it all the way to India. He got to the southern tip of India, and the Mar Thomas Church still stands there today, and there is still today a vibrant community of Christians trace their lineage all the way back to the first Christians who heard him preach. Simon the Zealot made it all the way to Britain before he was crucified. John is actually the only one who wasn't killed in some measure for his faith, and he lived out his final days in exile on the island of Patmos, where he received the vision that we know as the book of Revelation. In the end, every last one of them was given a chance at redemption. And not one of them ever dodged the weight of the cross again. See, you've undoubtedly had moments where you've gone after other gods, where you've refused the path that Jesus laid before you because you wanted to take what looked to be the easier, safer, less painful path. We all do it. We've all done it. We'll probably all do it again. But that doesn't mean you're lost. So long as you draw breath, Jesus will lead you. So long as you draw breath, you can choose the hard and difficult road that followers of Jesus are called to walk. You can still take up your cross and follow him. And my friends, looking at the lives the disciples lived, it looks to me as if the ones who abandon Jesus and learn their lesson are the ones destined for the greatest glory. In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, amen.